Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Michael Romore from the City University of New York.
And I'm your co-host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi from Princeton University.
So today I'm here to talk to Professor Sana Iyer, the author of Indians in Kenya, The Politics of Diaspora, published by Harvard University Press in 2015. Sana Iyer is Associate Professor of History at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and by discussing this book, we'll learn about the Indian diaspora in Kenya and the ways they sought political power both in colonial and post-independence context. Speaking from Atlanta, New York, welcome, Sana, to New Books in the Indian Ocean and World. And thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book.
Thanks very much, Emmett and Michael. I'm looking forward to this. And, thank you for inviting me to what is a really wonderful series.
Our pleasure. So let's just start with you. Can you start us off by saying a few words about yourself? That is, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study, and any influential mentors or scholars that particularly guided you.
Sure. So, when I started working on this book, my interviewees and anyone I would early, present this work to would inevitably assume that I was from East Africa. And in fact, the first time I went to East Africa was for my research. I was actually born in Karachi in Pakistan, but I grew up in Delhi. And I grew up in Delhi in the 1990s, which is what I think of as my formative years as a high schooler and then sort of an undergraduate. It was the 1990s where India was going through a whole bunch of transitions in terms of the economy. The economy had liberalized, opened up. Suddenly, Coke and Pepsi were available. My childhood Thumbs Up that had been produced locally was no longer the go-to soda drink. There were a whole bunch of sort of social and economic changes that had been brought about by liberalization. And there was also, on the other hand, politically, the early rise of Hindu nationalism, the first demands for building, a Ram temple in the place of a medieval mosque were being made. And it seemed as if sort of India was at this transition point, both economically, but even in terms of how the nation defined itself, and a kind of move away from early independence, the post-independence definition of India as a secular country is one that embraced unity in diversity. And, as someone coming into her sort of independent intellectual, moorings, I found that history was a good way to begin to understand the questions I should be asking. I had hoped that history would be the way in which I could get to the answers, but in fact, it was an entry point into understanding what was really at stake in that contemporary moment in the 1990s. And of course, once I, started my undergraduate degree in history, I was hooked. And, I've been a historian ever since I was 18 years old. And I went to, as I said, I did my undergraduate degree in India at the University of Delhi at St. Stephen's College. I then went on to pursue a second BA at the University of Cambridge in the UK. And then I came to Harvard in the US to do my PhD. And along the way, I have had an incredibly inspiring and supportive group of teachers and historians in school. My memory of someone making history exciting actually was my mother, who brought to me a book called Eyewitness to History that was about the Second World War. And, it was just sort of these oral histories that made me think, okay, actually, history is not just about dates. But in high school, I had a wonderful teacher called Biba Sopti. Once I got into St. Stephen's College, Shiv Shankar Menon, Tanika Sarkar, Rupinder Singh, who are all sort of in their own right, real sort of heavyweights as far as South Asian history is concerned, both in the modern period, but also sort of the ancient period. From Delhi, I went to Cambridge, where I studied under William Gold, whose work on communalism in North India was really influential to me. John Lonsdale, the doyen of East African Kenyan history, was, you know, in his penultimate year of teaching at Cambridge, and that's when I got interested in Kenyan history. And then, of course, I came to Harvard to work under Shugato Bose, whose work on the Indian Ocean had just been published, which, you know, clearly was super influential, you know, not just for me, but, you know, this entire new historiography on mobility in South Asia. I was lucky to have Caroline Elkins, who had just won her Pulitzer Prize for her book on the Mau Mau, who was on my committee. And, you know, those are sort of the teachers and the historians. But my main interlocutors, as I began to move from dissertation to book manuscript, were colleagues of mine, Africanist colleagues of mine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, as well as at Johns Hopkins. Jim Sweet and Neil Kodesh, you know, read the book, you know, from the perspective of Africanists who were extremely supportive and kind, but also critical, as was needed, to, you know, someone who was really a South Asianist interloper in their field. And Pierre Lawson, you know, whose work on the Indian Ocean for amongst Africanists has been hugely influential, was one of my mentors when I did a postdoc at Johns Hopkins. And I just wanted to mention him last but not the least, because he tragically passed away a couple of weeks ago. And it's a real loss to the field of Indian Ocean studies, as well as to me personally.
Thank you. So let's just turn to the book, Indians in Kenya. So how did the idea for this book in particular develop? And what was your research process like? And how was the writing experience overall?
You know, back in 2002, you know, many of these, you know, I realize as I get older that as historians, what we do and what we write about is always very intimately connected to our personhood and our personal experiences, although it wasn't all that clear to me as I got into this. But, you know, back in 2002, I was in England. I was studying at Cambridge. I was away from home for the very first time. And home had shifted. In February 2002, massive communal riots took place in Gujarat, you know, the worst riots at the time since independence. And as I was reading about it, trying to understand how the India that I knew had suddenly moved, you know, suddenly things that we had read about in history books seemed to be playing out, you know, in India, in Gujarat. You know, as I was reading a lot about it, I read that a lot of the funding for groups that had been at the forefront of pushing the Hindu nationalist agenda, a lot of that funding had come from the diaspora, in the UK, in the US, and elsewhere. And you know, having grown up in India, we had never really thought about the diaspora in a serious way. In some ways, you know, the Indians who didn't live in India were those who sort of left. They left, you know, before liberalization, when they thought they wouldn't, you know, especially those who went to places like the UK and the US. You know, we talked about the brain drain. We talked about those who, you know, seemed as if they didn't really want to do the hard work that was needed to build the nation. There was that sort of very tense relationship between Indians and the Indian diaspora in, you know, the more in developed, quote unquote, developed countries. So I hadn't really thought much about them. But then when I read about this funding coming in, the question for me was, well, Hindu nationalism is this territorial, religious, nationalist political project in India. So why are Hindus in you know, in London, why are Hindus in New York, why are Hindus sort of in California interested in sending money back to these organizations? And that's where I got interested in identity and what the relationship between the diaspora, the Indian diaspora is between its homeland, India, and the places where they were. So, you know, this was sort of in the backdrop of my, you know, non-classroom thinking. When I went into the classroom with John Lonsdale, who I'd mentioned, who was offering a class on the Mau Mau Rebellion. And part of why I had taken that class was, you know, I was writing a thesis on South Asian history at Delhi University. In the 3 years that I did my BA, it was all about, you know, mostly Indian South Asian history and a little bit of European history. We hadn't really learned anything about Africa. In fact, you know, in many ways, Africa was like this blank space in our, you know, in our sort of collective imagination, but also in the sort of historical imagination. We knew about Gandhi, of course, but only that, you know, Gandhi was in South Africa for a while and he comes back like a Mahatma. There were no details. I certainly, you know, when I, so I wanted to take a class that would teach me something completely new, but wasn't so completely out of my purview that I would, you know, do very badly and not be able to deal with it. So this class on the Mama Rebellion that I knew nothing about in a country called Kenya that I knew nothing about just sort of triggered my interest. And within the first 2 weeks, I was completely hooked. And, you know, John Lonsdale used to talk, you know, it was mostly about the rebellion, but there were a few names, Pio Gama Pinto and Makhan Singh, that came up. And I recognized them immediately as being South Asian names. I even recognized them as being Punjabi, Sikh, and Goan names. And when I asked Lonsdale about it, he said, you know, there is this dissertation to be written, but, you know, we know about the Uganda expulsions, we know about South Africa, but in fact, there was a substantial number of Indians in Kenya. So that's when, you know, I had been thinking about the diaspora and its relationship with India because of the Gujarat riots, you know, had gotten interested in Kenyan history because of Lonsdale. And then, you know, there were these Indians in Kenya. So that's when I began to read a little bit around them. And I applied for my PhD to Harvard, you know, to work on what was actually initially a project on the rise of Hindu nationalism amongst the diaspora, and within that, the diaspora in the UK, and more specifically, the very first group of Hindus who mobilized in the UK were those who came from East Africa. So I thought that I had found this wonderful connection. But as happens, and, you know, in fact, my advisor, Shagatha Bose, still tells me you were supposed to have written that the dissertation on the rise of Hindu nationalism in the UK. And what you ended up doing something else. And, you know, that in a way is the research project and the research process and the writing process. I was able to get a grant to go to Kenya the first year of grad school just to go and check out the archives there. And, you know, I just found an amazing set of documents. I was able to contact a whole bunch of people and activists in Nairobi itself. And it was really the archives that then led me to the project, you know, the dissertation and then the book that focused on Indians in Kenya. And as happens, you know, the whole process in graduate school was learning and unlearning how to write. You know, a seminar paper is different from what you produce as the first draft of the chapter. And, you know, that has basically continued. The book manuscript, I think, went through at least three massive rewrites. Much of that because of those interlocutors I had, Neil Kodesh, Jim Sweet, and Pierre Lawson. But it was also about sort of, you know, the field itself was developing. When I started off doing this research back in 2004, there were very few people working on the politics of, you know, African and Asian relations in East Africa. But, you know, by the end of it, there's a critical mass there. And I think that the rewriting really was about those conversations, you know, the sharing of ideas, the contestation of framing, how we frame the material we find, and of course, finding that material.
Thanks. And that leads actually to my next question, which is, how do you see the book intervening in scholarship on migration and empire in the Indian Ocean?
You know, there's been, I sometimes wish that graduate programs would just have the Indian Ocean sort of field. And in some ways, I think the scholarship and the graduate students have pushed the field of South Asian history into the Indian Ocean. You know, but as I said, when I started out, you know, there was Shagatha Bose, who, of course, had written his really sort of, I think, significant historiographical intervention in Indian Ocean studies. But, you know, at the same time, Tom Metcalf has also written his work on the Indian Ocean, and it seemed as if people were moving away from this idea of politics, nationalism, and territoriality to look at the horizons of the ocean. And those early works, I think, were really formative in expanding out, you know, what in sort of really reconceptualizing who and what and the people and the goods and the spaces that constitute South Asia. But ultimately, I think for both those books, the idea had been to tie it back into India, ultimately. And but there were a whole bunch of these openings, you know, the mobility was one of them, right? The migration and some of those, and capital. So some of the work that had looked at the migration of, you know, people across the Indian Ocean had tended to look at an indenture and continue sort of to do so. But there were, of course, you know, there's capital too. There's capitalism. There's capitalism that wasn't just colonial capitalism, but West Indian capitalism as well, from the Western Indian post. So I began, you know, I was reading these works. There is now, as I said, a critical mass. But I found what was frustrating about the work that came out just on diaspora was that the diaspora tended to be classified and understood in sort of these almost sort of social science terms of push and pull factors. And those were ultimately not as nuanced as I was looking for. They sort of took away the intimacy and the everyday mundaneness of what a migrant, you know, the position actually of a migrant, the experience of the migrant. It also tended to frame the figure of the migrant as, alienated from both the host land and the homeland, and a kind of what I think is a false binary was set up in those frameworks of, you know, the homeland and the host land being completely sort of separate. And so when I was starting out this project and as I began to develop it, I really sort of looked at three key themes, space, race, and place. By space, I meant sort of, you know, what is diasporic consciousness, right? The figure of the immigrant and its relationship with the homeland and hostland, not simply as scaffolding for us to really, you know, look at the homeland and hostland as separate, but really sort of to look at two homelands, right, and not flatten out the figure of the migrant into one sort. The second was place. I think that we have to really keep into play both mobility and territoriality. So this wasn't, you know, I was very clear that I wasn't going to write a book on the cosmopolitanism of Indians. I think that there is a place there and there's some excellent work that has been done on it. But territory, you know, but as much as mobility was a key factor in this diasporic consciousness, so was territoriality. And ultimately, this is a story about Indians in Kenya. And there's something that is distinctive, I think, about that history and that experience that I wanted to look at. And then lastly was race. And I think that it is here that really the conversation on race and understanding racial consciousness can shift away from colonial frameworks of race being understood as black versus white or a brown versus white, but actually look at Asian, South Asian African entanglements of racial understanding as a kind of shifting field of discourse and shifting sort of structural frameworks within which to place the Indians and Africans. And it's from there that I really sort of pulled out and said, well, you know, actually, we cannot even think about race relations as something singular. And in fact, what you have here is race being deployed both to distance by Indians in Kenya to both distance themselves from Africans, but also to establish proximity. And it was that messiness and that sort of focus on the shifting forms of discourses of identity and claim making that I think ultimately was sort of the hook for my book.
These are definitely worthwhile interventions in the field. And I would add also that contrary to the previous scholarship that sort of disconnects 1750 from what came after, this also connects the early modern long dure connections between South Asia and East Africa into the 20th century.
Absolutely.
I would like now to turn to the book and its chapters. The book is divided in six chapters with an introduction and epilogue. In the introduction, we learn that the Indian population in Kenya increased dramatically between 1887 and 1968 from about 7,000 to over 175,000. How did the dynamics of migration and settlement change over the course of the 19th and the 20th century? And if I may add, could you give us a basic introduction to the history of South Asian migrations to East Africa? Where did they come from? When and why? What was their relationship to indigenous Africans? And what were some of the economic activities that the Indians were involved in?
Thanks, Ahmed. That's a huge, huge question. And in some ways, that was absolutely what the book was about. So I'm going to sort of parse, I think, some nuggets from that. Just sort of very, very broadly in terms of migration patterns, there had been, you know, as you alluded to, there had been, of course, contact between, across the Indian Ocean, between East Africa and South Asia for centuries. There is something that I think shifts in the late 19th century. And the shift is both in terms of numbers, but also in terms of intimacy, the intimacy of contact, right? So the numbers increase quite clearly because of British imperialism, right? Once India becomes a colony, East Africa, certainly sort of Kenya and Uganda, and then eventually Tanganyika after the First World War become part of the British Empire, there are opportunities. There's both sort of a vision, right? An idea of space that gets kind of anchored along the imperial map. There is, of course, the old proximity and the old networks. But what happens is that there's a rise in the numbers of people who go to trade across to East Africa. So you have a lot of traders. And these traders are no longer simply people who are going in dhows to go and collect goods and bring them back. But there's a kind of multiple layer of economic interaction and anchoring that takes place as British, as sort of East Africa comes under British rule, wherein sort of the traders, you have sort of those who are going back and forth, but you also have, across the littoral realms of the Indian Ocean, but you also have a move into the hinterland as new opportunities come up for trade and the demand for Indian goods kind of comes up. So you have sort of, in a way, three layers of trading activity. You have the oceanic trade. You have those who become fairly big firms in places like Mombasa, in places like Zanzibar, that are basically overseeing import and export, but also sending out goods to the smaller retailers in the hinterland on consignment, on the basis of consignment. And there you get sort of the petty shopkeepers who were known as dukawalas in East Africa. But it isn't just traders who go to East Africa. The East African Railway is laid and about 30,000 indentured laborers are taken from India, about 10,000 of whom choose to stay back, and they end up working in the railways as skilled workers or setting up shops themselves. And by the early 1910s, late 1910s, early 1920s, you get a whole class of professionals. You get teachers and lawyers and doctors who are also coming through from East Africa, from India into East Africa looking for jobs. So you see a whole bunch of people of different sort of kinds of job descriptions and from all over India. You have Punjabis, Gujaratis, Goans. These are the three main predominant groups that end up coming in. You have Hindus and Muslims. So there is a divergence and a diversity of the kind of Indian who comes in. But in terms of scholarship, but also in terms of, to some extent, popular discourse, the image of, quote-unquote, the Indian becomes kind of flattened out into the exploitative trader, right, who remained aloof from the people whom he traded with and was around. And it's that question that I really, wanted to unpack, but also investigate a little more. After all, how can trading, especially barter trade in the more, in the hinterlands, outside of the big cities, that was based so much on a back and forth. Any of us who have ever been to a flea market, right, anywhere in the world, know that actually shopping is a very intimate experience. You have to know where to go. You end up returning to the same shop, so you get to know the shopkeepers. There's a amount of teasing that goes on. Negotiating in an informal setting in a shop is something that only people who are familiar with terms, terminology, etiquette, can really engage in. And so the shopkeepers are showing up. They are, ultimately sort of bartering, trading in Swahili. And the face, and, this has been sort of taking place right through the end of the century. But what happens as the colonial state really establishes its hold in East Africa and tries to bring Africans into the monetized colonial economy, that's when that relationship between the Indian trader and the African customer really shifts. The colonial state is essentially interested in making sure that it gets taxed, making sure that African labor makes itself available for its various infrastructural projects as well as its agrarian projects. It also is trying to make sure that, and it does so by taxing. Because it's only if you impose really high taxes can you force someone who otherwise is living, is able to provide for themselves. That's when they'll be forced to actually come out and perform labor. And they also are trying to sort of monetize by moving away from barter into introducing sort of colonial currency. The Indian trader, right, the person that you go to for your everyday supplies, be it oil, be it tire for your bike, for your bicycle, be it clothes, as they gonna come, they start coming in, be it sort of items of modern living like a clock or a watch or shoes, those all are being sold in the Indian trader's shop. And so the Indian trader sort of becomes this face of colonialism. And that in some ways really does establish the relationship, the economic relationship between Africans and Indians. And in the interland, sort of indigenous, Africans are coming into the shop saying, okay, I have this sack of maize and I need to sell the sack of maize to pay my taxes in actual currency and also to buy everyday goods. And the Indian shop became the place where you would not only buy your sell your agricultural produce, but also buy your everyday needs. And the fact that the Indian trader was both the salesman, in that sense, the salesman and the sort of purchaser, they ended up being able to manipulate the rates that they charged for buying and selling in a way that it would make it profitable for them. And that creates a kind of structural economic relationship that was extremely difficult to move away from. And, we'll get into what happens sort of later on. But that gets established super early on. But that isn't to say that, that's the only relationship. And, I really want to caution against thinking about the Indian immigrant or the relationship between Africans and Indians as, as something that was consistent, that was a single story. In fact, there is no single story. So a helpful way to think about this relationship really is in thinking about, historical contingencies. And I sort of break up some of this time period into the early colonial period that is up to the First World War, the 1920s and 50s, which I think of as a kind of period of high colonialism, but also anti-colonialism. And then the 1950s through the early 70s, which I think of as sort of really that post-colonial period. And at every stage, at every one of these chronological sort of moments, there are shifting claims, there are shifting sort of discourses of identity and claim making that are deployed to assert a certain kind of position in the public political realm.
Yeah, and you unpack that throughout the chapters, which move chronologically, and it makes us really rethink categories such as what does it mean to be an Indian, Asian, African, Kenyan over the first part of the 20th century. In the first chapter, from the America of the Hindu to white man's country, in what sense were Kenyan Indians imbricated in the British colonial project, to think broadly? For example, is it fair to say that to describe Indians in Kenya as settlers or quote-unquote sub-imperialists? Did the British encourage or reject some Indians' attempt to equate themselves with the white settlers in the Kenyan highlands? And what measures did they respond with by the 1920s?
That's a really good question. Thank you for that. And it's one that I grappled a lot with. Were Indians settlers, settlers of the same sort that Europeans were? And was their settlement similar to settler colonialism? And I know that, settler colonialism in lots of new works that are coming out now on Indian migration is really sort of the analytical framework that some new scholarship is talking about. I actually don't necessarily take that same view. I thought about settler colonialism as a framework. I ultimately found it not all that helpful in trying to unpack the very nuanced and shifting relationship between certain Indian migrants and the state, right? The colonial state, the European settlers and Africans. We have to think about what the Indians in East Africa are doing and the various different communities and groups within which they are trying to establish relationships into which they are entangled. Now, that's why I sort of end up using sub-imperialism. Now, when I think about settler colonialism, I think about a group of people who come in to take land, right, to settle. That settlement is an overt act of dispossession of the land, of those who originally belonged, who lived there. But there's also, and, you know, Indians in some ways are sort of part of that. But the other piece is that settler colonialism was very much about establishing state power, right? It was about empire building, establishing state power. And I didn't, having representation, self-governance, right? That was a sort of South African model. That's what the European settlers in Kenya are trying to do. I did not find any evidence of the Indian. So I found evidence of Indian settling, right? There definitely are traders who are going in for economic opportunities. They are, you know, the richer capitalists who are thinking of, more broadly, beyond just their shop. But I did not see evidence of even those who were going in with the intent of settling. I didn't see there any evidence of them actually trying to reserve state power for themselves. And in the absence of that imperial project, for me, what was more useful in terms of a framework was thinking about these early settlers as sub-imperialists, right? So they are, this is not to say that they weren't in, I think in the pre-First World War period, very much part of the colonial project. They were not critical of colonialism, imperialism, or even settler colonialism. But I don't see them as settler colonists themselves because there's that absence of the desire or aspiration even to grab state power. There was never any question of Indians having self-governance, of Indians defining self-governance as Indians governing either Europeans or Africans, right? But what they were was, and that's why, for that first chapter, the framework that I found much more useful analytically to position these early traders was that of imperial citizenship. They weren't thinking of themselves at this point as Indians in a nationalist sense, right, in a political sense. They thought of themselves as Indians in a civilizational sense. But they thought of themselves really first, in terms of the political relationship with the state, it was very much about imperial citizenship. They were allowed, for example, to migrate. And the reason why they were able to, their argument against the European settlers who were trying to stop their immigration was, well, we have the right to mobility because we are imperial citizens. And to be a citizen of the empire means that you can go and settle anywhere. So imperial citizenship is very much the term that I would, is how I would describe them. But of course, as we said, everything is historically contingent. And, imperial citizenship is deployed as a means to try and grab some amount of rights. And those rights are then denied. And then they sort of, drop that language of imperial citizenship. As far as the question of the British, again, much as the Indians are not sort of a singular category, the British aren't either. There was a difference in this early response there was a difference in this early time period between the response of the European settlers in Kenya itself, who immediately made the argument that, the Indians are racially different, civilizationally and racially different from us and inferior, that we do not want them anywhere, that they should not be allowed land, they should, in fact, immigration should be stopped completely. So that was the attitude of the European settlers, many of whom were British, but many were also from South Africa. Within India itself, the colonial government of India, so they are also the British in some ways, but their interest and their scope of activity is sort of limited to India. So the India office and the government of India, in fact, takes the side of these Indian imperial citizens. And Tom Metcalf, I think, brings this out really beautifully when he talks about how India really, if we have to think about the Indian Ocean region, India is a jewel in the crown, not just for, the entire empire, but really it's the Indian empire across the Indian Ocean. And, there were documents and files that I saw where this idea of imperial citizenship was really one that is first, embraced by colonial officials who are, colonizers in India, but are very much supporting this capital, the Indian capitalism, the big trade that is going on in East Africa, and they are pushing against the European settlers. And, very much saying that the European settlers are racist against the Indians and, the British Crown must come in and intervene. And London, in that way, the colonial office is very much a balancing act in this period between the European settlers and the government of India. And in fact, initially, they come down on the side of the Indians, and then sort of that gets reversed. But again, I think it's really important, you know, when we think about colonialism, we think about, you know, the colonizers and colonial subjects as if, again, these are neat categories where it's very clear who has power and who doesn't. When in fact, on the everyday basis, you know, when you look in the weeds, things are much more complicated. And there are these overlapping, and, you know, that's why I always go back to trying to unpack this as claim making, right? Who is making what claim and for what? And again, this is sort of shifting.
Yes. And during this time that you examine in the book, during the rise of anti-colonial politics, you also have the notion of civilization and developing discourses of Indian civilization, which seems to represent a collision between colonial era racial classifications and pre-colonial Indian Ocean hierarchies. So do you think this tension Justin's cosmopolitan accounts of Afro-Asian or Indian Ocean histories?
Thanks for that question. You know, and yes, as I said at the beginning, you know, cosmopolitanism has been a framework for understanding this mobility. And as I said, there is a place for it, but it really, it's the local moorings get lost. And there is a territoriality. And that sort of comes back to that second intervention of mine of place, where place is not just about, you know, where you are, but also the mobility, right? The sort of crossing of spaces, in fact. And notions of civilization absolutely were informed by what I would call colonial modernity. And claim making. But there also is, as you said, you know, identity is not something that is, you know, only a colonial invention, and the deployment of identity in political claim making, I think, is something that happens, you know, in the context of colonial modernity. Now, the way in which I tried to bring in and think about diasporic consciousness with these ideas of race, civilization, that were being deployed in the sub-imperialist kind of politics, what I found really helpful was to then go back to sort of thinking about that division that early scholarship had in diaspora scholarship between the homeland and the hostland, right? You know, the notion was, well, you know, you come, you know, the push factor is like you come from somewhere and then you end up settling somewhere, but in this liminal space where you don't really belong. And, this much of that theorization came from, you know, post-colonial scholarship and theory on that was trying to critique the nation. But ultimately, I think it really positioned the diaspora in this liminal space that in a way alienated it from where they were. And in fact, when I looked at the kind of claim making, even when, you know, discourses of civilization and race were being deployed by sub-imperialist traders, you know, that language of imperial citizenship, it was not because they didn't want to belong in the quote-unquote hostland, but in fact, the civilizational discourse of where they came from was being deployed to make claims of belonging to where they were. And so I actually ended up dropping the language of hostland completely. And in fact, thought about diasporic consciousnesses really being about having two homelands. The civilizational homeland that's kind of located, you know, in terms of actual migration, of course, is sort of South Asia, India, but also in the imaginative sort of realm of where we come from, you know, what is our civilization? That civilization is the Indian ancient civilization, right? That was the language that was being deployed. So there certainly was a, you know, India, the homeland, right? The territory of India, the space of India, the idea of India looms large in this diasporic consciousness, but it isn't looming large to alienate or distance themselves from belonging in Kenya. In fact, it was a political claim. And that's why I talk about the hostland really as being a political homeland, a claim to belonging. So, you know, that the civilizational identity is deployed to make the civilizational identity, which I really think comes from mobility, is being deployed to make extremely territorial and local political claims in Kenya. And so I talk about these sort of two homelands as a way to understand that. And I think that that rootedness, right, that anchor makes this framing of the Indian Ocean migration space is something that is a little different from the discourse, you know, from the frameworks of cosmopolitanism that have been used in other works of the Indian Ocean. Because I think that, you know, for the migrants and their claim making, there is an aspect, they are cosmopolitan in scope, but they are very local and particular in their moorings, in their actual anchors.
Yeah, and the following chapter, Political Homelands Across the Indian Ocean, definitely picks up on these Indian political claims in an anti-colonial context. So what were some of the manifestations of the Indian anti-colonial politics in post-World War I Kenya? And can you tell us more about the new African-Indian alliances that were forged and what sort of internal and external challenges they faced through the Second World War?
Sure. And this really sort of gets to the heart of the book in some ways. And I think it was the first chapter that I had even started working on. Now, you know, as I said, that, you know, all these positions and identities and discourses of claim making were historically contingent. And that early chronology, you know, that chronology that I had offered at the beginning of sort of the pre-First World War period as being one of settler, of imperial citizenship, sub-imperialism. Now, that politics, it was very clear by the First World War, simply was not working, right? And it wasn't working because of the European settlers. The Indian traders kept deploying languages of civilization. And, you know, by civilization, essentially what they were saying was, we are modern, right? That we know about money and capital. That's what we do. We are, you know, we come here to be part of the colonial project in that we are absolutely integral to creating this colonial economy, to get labor out onto the lands, you know, to get African labor out of their reserves onto sort of these colonial projects through, you know, we're the ones who are enabling tax collection. So, you know, that's what they meant really by civilization. What they meant was, we are modern, we are, you know, we are not African in many ways, is what they meant. But that language simply didn't fly because the European settlers and also the governor of Kenya, ultimately, who was very supportive of them, essentially said, well, the thing is that you can't really be making these claims to equity with European settlers, because after all, you might have a civilization, we don't deny that, but your civilization is not really modern, which is why back in India, you are still colonial subjects. And they then pushed it even further to say that, well, you know, if we did allow you to come in and, you know, buy land and things, you ultimately would be a bad influence for the Africans. And on the one hand, they did this to distance and, in fact, stop any claim that the Indians might have made to, you know, sharing the white man's burden, as it were, in terms of the civilizing mission, as far as Africans were concerned. But they also began to say, and, you know, look at how exploitative, you know, they said, it isn't we who've taken away lands from Africans who are the exploitative ones. It's the Indians who in their shops are cheating the Africans, who are charging them high rates, who are really impoverishing them. So they are in that way a bad influence as well. So the Indians, you know, by the First World War within Kenya, they kind of realized that this language of imperial citizenship is simply not going to work and is not getting them any of their demands, because the hold of the settler colonists, the Europeans, was so strong. And again, this is a particularly Kenyan phenomena, right? The same is not really quite the same dynamic as is happening in India and elsewhere. Meanwhile, of course, in India, you know, after the First World War, there is a shift in the kind of politics and the embrace of anti-colonialism that takes place, you know, not entirely under Gandhi's leadership, but, you know, he is one of the key figures who goes back and is able to sort of mobilize right after the First World War during the Khilafat non-cooperation movement. And the Indians, and, you know, I should have said this at the beginning, the Indian migrants are not simply migrating without and never returning to India, which is quite different from the migrants who go to the Caribbean and, you know, further out. But these are kind of circular migrations. And, you know, you could be a migrant who, you know, a trader or even a skilled worker in the railways who goes to East Africa. You then, you know, if you're a man, you kind of return to India, to your homeland, you know, to your home country, home village or your hometown in Gujarat or Punjab to marry someone. You bring your wife across, then you have children. The wife often goes back to have her child back in India, spends a couple of years, comes back. to East Africa. Then when the child is, you know, school going, they are sent back to Bombay if you're rich enough. So, you know, there's a lot of back and forth. And there's, of course, sort of new waves of migrants who come in. And so it's right after that First World War that, in fact, you have sort of the rise of Nash anti-colonialism in India, and some new younger generation of migrants who are coming in are of that political bend. But there's also been that shift within Kenya where the language of imperial citizenship and sub-imperialism has simply not led to any actual gains. And there's a realization that, you know, the gains have not been made because ultimately race and racial consciousness is a great factor. And so the Indians in East Africa actually shift that language into talking about themselves as non-Europeans, right? That we as non-Europeans must have these rights. And the minute you talk about being non-European and not simply as being Indian or of Indian civilization, you are including in your imaginative scope and scale and actual sort of scale other non-European people, i.e. Africans. And so right at the First World, you know, end of the First World War, you have, in fact, the very first alliance that takes place between a Kikuyu leader, Harry Thuku, and the Indian Kenyan East African Indian National Congress, where they really they are coming back. They are coming together around this, around different specifics and frustrations and claims, you know, in terms of the everyday lives that, for the Africans, it's about carrying identity cards, about their high taxes. For the Indians, it's more about immigration issues and not being able to buy land. But what they are both realizing in their spheres is that actually they are being denied all of this because they are being seen as non-Europeans. And there's a language of solidarity that builds up with an actual practical alliance. And this is an early one. Now, I want to emphasize that this doesn't mean that it takes place immediately and there's this mass mobilization of, you know, how hundreds of thousands of Africans and Indians rising up together. But there are these ideas, right? There's a sharing of ideas. So Harry Thuku also looking at, other places where colonialism is being critiqued and people are being mobilized around, particularly in India's case, Harry Thuku sort of gets really interested in Gandhi himself in the Khilafat non-cooperation movement. Positions himself, in fact, as the Gandhi of Kenya, right? So again, there's a kind of cosmopolitanism in thinking and ideas, although the implementation is really, really specific. So that happens in the 1920s. By the 1930s, there is, in fact, the rise of urban unrest and labor movements. And here again, you know, in Mombasa, predominantly the labor is African, but the first trade union that is established for Indian skilled and unskilled workers in the railway. So again, it isn't simply a story about the Gujarati traders, but in fact, the Punjabi workers. And this happens in Nairobi. And Makhan Singh, who's at the forefront of this right from the early 1930s, is talking about allying, you know, and he's sort of, he is of a leftist orientation. In fact, he announces, "I am a communist. I fight for the freedom of all countries." And he very much is embracing an interracial kind of urban politics, which is successful for a while. And I would say that the peak success of this interracial alliance is one that takes place in the realm of, you know, in that moment of anti-colonialism of non-European people before nationhood is actually being defined and negotiated. So, and this would be sort of the late 1940s through the early 1950s, where in fact the very first demand for independence in Kenya, right, you know, complete independence, not just the small demands of wages and voting rights, but the demand for complete sovereignty and independence is made in 1950 led in public by Makhan Singh, the Punjabi Sikh leader of the trade union movement.
Yeah, and then the following chapter between rebellion and suppression takes us forward to the Mau Mau period. So what led to the Mau Mau rebellion against the British, and what was the response of Kenyan Indians to that struggle?
So the Mau Mau rebellion, it was, again, many things. There's no single story, and there's a whole historiography of scholars who have dedicated their life and careers to studying this who are disagreed on exactly what it is. So, you know, what I give you here is a very basic, brief sort of overview of events. It was at heart a movement to demand land. How the way in which the colonial state in Kenya was set up with the European settlers was, European settlers were sort of invited in the late 1890s, early 1900s, to basically take over what were called the highlands, which were extremely fertile land, and they were, there was a huge PR campaign to bring them in to try and make these lands productive, which for the most part they weren't, because the European settlers who came in didn't really have any farming experience. And so they needed labor to work on their land. That land is kind of claimed. The land itself was land where Maasai communities had been living, but they were nomadic. And then the Kikuyu had begun to come in just when the European settlers were also sitting in. But what happens, by the early 20th century is that the European farmers have these huge acres of land in the highlands, and they need people to come and cultivate them. And so they allow Kikuyu workers, known as squatters, to basically cultivate a little bit of that land for themselves and then work on their farms. And for the Kikuyu, this essentially meant that they had right to that land. And for a variety of sort of reasons, including the mechanization of farms, all of this sort of shifts after the Second World War, and the European settlers move to push away these squatters off their lands. And the squatters say, well, these are our lands. We've been living here for generations. The European farmers say, well, no, actually, we don't need your labor any longer and you have no land rights. So they become essentially landless. The initial movement, Mau-Mau movement, as we trace back to the beginnings, is with a group of squatters who say, well, the highlands are our ancestral land and we want it back, right? And that sort of starts the movement to basically demand that the highlands are returned to those who, have an indigenous claim with it. But I will sort of put the indigenous in quotes because, as I said, there's, the land belonged to many, and the Kikuyu squatter, the Kikuyu who were settled on those lands right as the European settlers were coming in were in fact themselves sort of new settlers in that context. But they basically, build up and mobilize around the return of their ancestral lands to, throw the Europeans out, and essentially for freedom, right? And this is sort of an expression of freedom. In that sense, one could interpret it as a nationalist movement, but it wasn't simply the squatters in the highlands. The labor unrest that I'd mentioned in places like Mombasa and also Nairobi of the interwar period, that is also very much part of what becomes the Mau-Mau rebellion. And so for the laborers, it was issues of wages and the working hours that mobilized them against the colonial state. And then there's also internal shifts that were taking place within the Kikuyu. There's a kind of generational shift where gender played a huge role, because under Kikuyu custom, you couldn't really marry until, as a man, you couldn't get yourself a bride unless you had some amount of land, right? You had to, quote unquote, become a man, become an adult before you could claim that you wanted to get married. But in the era of extreme, extremely limited land, because the best of the land had been taken away, the Kikuyu had been put into reserves. These reserves were now overflowing with people. Young Kikuyu men found that generationally their own elders were preventing them from getting married, right? Saying that, well, you're not really an adult, you're still a boy. And so the Mau-Mau rebellion, also becomes one that a lot of younger Kikuyu men and women end up joining. There's a sort of generational conflict. And the Mau-Mau are, on the one hand, of course, against, for freedom, and it's the land and for land and freedom. They call themselves the Land and Freedom Army. But it also was a civil war in some ways of the younger generation against the older. And violence becomes the way in which this protest, this rebellion sort of takes place. The violence was not just amongst the European settlers, but in fact, the largest number who died at the hands of the rebels were the Kikuyu elder themselves, and those who were seen as supporting the colonial state. Now, the colonial state comes down really, really strong, and this is where Caroline Elkins's work, she calls it genocidal, right? She calls it the British Gulag. That's the Gulag. That's one of the terms that she uses. describe this counterinsurgency. She talks about the concentration camps that were set up. Essentially, the colonial state responds in a massive way by deploying arms, by singling out, you know, by essentially picking up all young Kikuyu, putting them into a pipeline system of camps to try and sort of to break them out of the Mau Mau mode. And it's in this, and an emergency, a long emergency is declared for about 8 years that, you know, arms them with extraordinary power to the colonial state, with extraordinary power to essentially, impose, to use violence, to shut down any kind of threat and dissent. Now, the Indian response in all of this, again, as I've been sort of saying, there's no single story, right? There's no single response. In fact, part of what the Indians claimed was ineffective was that, you know, we didn't really have a united voice. But that didn't mean that they didn't have a voice. Right at the beginning, the Indian National Congress that had been, the East African Indian National Congress that had been sort of part of those early alliances with Harith Huku, with, even the trade unions, they had, they, along with Indian lawyers, Indian newspaper, Indian edited newspapers, they actually supported the anti-colonial, recognized and then supported the anti-colonial aspects of the Mau Mau rebellion. They said, the Kikuyu should have their land back, that they should be allowed to vote, that there should be freedom. Now, they didn't go as far as to condone the violence of the rebels, but they chose instead to focus on the violence of the counterinsurgency. And, Jawaharlal Nehru, who had become by now, of course, India's first prime minister, and his hand-selected diplomat, High Commissioner sent to East Africa, Appa Pant, they were very much focused on criticizing the counterinsurgency rather than the insurgency, amplifying the demand for independence that was absolutely at the heart of the rebellion. And then there were a handful of those who actually actively supported the rebels rebel leaders by supplying some guns, by protecting them in their houses when the army came in to basically sweep up any suspected rebel. But there was also a citizen vigilante group, especially amongst traders who lived in isolated areas that, came up. And, they are the ones who actively tried to arm themselves, to defend themselves against rebels for economic reasons, but also political reasons. And what you get during the Mau Mau rebellion are two figures who in some ways represent the polar opposites of the Indian responses to the rebellion. You have Piyogama Pinto, who was a Goan radical, who absolutely supported the rebellion and in fact comes in, when the African leaders of the main political organization are all arrested, he sort of comes in and works very closely with those who haven't been until, of course, he is arrested as well. Makhan Singh, the urban trade union leader who I mentioned, had in fact been arrested a few, before the rebellion itself. He remains incarcerated right throughout the emergency. And then there's a man called Mangad, who was a lawyer, who, although he had been very supportive of the anti-colonialism of the 1930s and 40s, he ends up speaking out very loudly against the methods of the rebels and begins to deploy the language of civilization again to kind of distance Indians from Africans. And, he tries to negotiate by the end of the rebellion years with the colonial state for more Indian representation within politics. This is just to say that there is, rebellions are these really interesting moments in history where you think of them as these inflection points. And because of that, there is no single story to them. And what I found really compelling about when I was doing the research on this was to really uncover the voices of those who, have been dismissed in historiography as sort of unrepresentative of the whole, when in fact it was clear that there is no whole, right? Which is why you could have all this multiplicity of voices. And as historians, our job really is to give, to really unpack the different voices, even those that ultimately were not remembered were not that successful in mobilizing around. And, what's been really wonderful to see after, the book has come out is new scholarship by young graduate students who are beginning to revisit, big rebellions and look at, you know, not just sort of the main ethnicity or the main community that was participated in the rebellion, but actually look at those, the others, right, the outliers who joined in. And I have a graduate student, Trishna Patel, who's looking at, who's writing her PhD on Southern Rhodesia in the 1970s and is finding very similar figures to Pio Gama Pinto, who had been part of this, you know, what is known as sort of the insurgency, the guerrilla warfare, but in fact were intimately entangled with, you know, political leaders and others who had become part of this rebellion. And I think that that's where we move away just from thinking about these figures as cosmopolitan Indian Ocean figures, but really looking at territoriality and the rootedness of their politics, even as they absolutely, you know, were connected with other spaces and people.
Yeah, and I think the following chapter, Negotiating Nationhood, also speaks to this complicated character of anti-colonial responses. So in this chapter, you show how in the years directly preceding Kenyan independence, that African and Indian political leaders debated over different formulations of statehood that reflected competing definitions of nationhood. So what was at stake in the tension between racial and territorial belonging in Kenya during this period? And how did this tension shape the politics of decolonization?
So this in some ways is key, right? And I think that this ultimately comes back to the problem of nationalism and the problem of defining citizenship as mapping race onto place. And, you know, in some ways, this does go back to those early European settler objections to the presence of Indians in East Africa, which were really about saying, well, you know, Indians belong to India because they are, you know, quote unquote, racially Indian, right? That their race, and by race, you know, race is sort of this, the term Indian or Asian was used really as a register for a whole number of things, civilizational hierarchies, religious sort of differences and others. But there's this sense, I think, and again, it comes with colonial modernity, that, you know, race and place can be neatly mapped onto one another, when of course they can't, right? They aren't. But what makes a nation, right? What makes the nation is the territory, and those who belong are those who racially belong. And this is very much, the shift that takes place between, you know, in world history, between imperial politics, right? Empires versus nations. There's a sense that, you know, you can define nationhood, and that to be a citizen means that you, and that you can, and belonging to that nation is dependent on citizenship. And I think this is absolutely where the tension in some ways of negotiating nationhood comes up, even though there was that, you know, what I could think of as a glorious era of collaboration, of interracial solidarity. And this happens in a couple of ways. One is that, and this is where I go back to that issue of structure and the colonial economy and the structures that were put into place. Ultimately, Indians were, as migrants or as children of migrants, were a numerical minority in East Africa. And it was, they were a numerical minority who could be identified because they self-identified, as racially, as a racial unit, right? All those claims of civilization, you know, that sub-imperialist era of talking about Indians as being, having a civilizational homeland and all of that diasporic consciousness, you know, that doesn't go away. So being Indian or Asian is absolutely a discursive, is on the one hand a discursive form of identity that then begged the question of, well, then if Indians are sort of different from Africans, do they actually belong in the African nation? Now, Indians, as I said, were this racial minority, but although they were a racial minority, they had a lot of economic power and stability, right? They were not impoverished. They were not, the largest number. And although they were a minority, in terms of the economic power, well, the economic sort of position that they had in the Kenyan economy, in the colonial economy, was one, in fact, of power and majority. They were, in that sense, a majority within their within the colonial economy. And so the big question and as I had also said, the relationship, right, the economic relationship between Africans and Indians was very much of that shop and what happened in the shop. And, you know, in some ways, after the Second World War, there's a move of Indian traders, those who were the richer ones, into manufacture. But ultimately, Indians were better educated compared to Africans. Indian skilled workers got more jobs and better wages than the Africans. And as I said, you know, they had sort of this practical monopoly over the trade sector. So the big question at, you know, as decolonization and nationhood, you know, became imminent was what ultimately what does decolonization and independence mean? Is it simply a transfer of power from British and European settler hands to African hands? Or is it really about justice and equity that would mean a radical transformation of the structures that were in place, right, of the economic structures that put Africans at the bottom of, you know, one could think of it as a pyramid of the colonial economy, a racial pyramid, where Europeans were at the top, Indians were in some ways economically in the middle, and the Africans were at the very bottom. So what would, you know, so once the emergency comes to an end, once, you know, decolonization is imminent, the question about nationhood became, well, you know, who ultimately belongs to the nation? And if the nation is about race and place, then, you know, the discourse, cosmopolitan discourse of Africa for Africans ultimately puts Indians in this, you know, position where Indians either have to identify as African, right, self-identify, but also be accepted as Africans by those who are claiming a politics of indigeneity and belonging first. And also, what does decolonization mean in terms of a radical transformation? And were those squatters who were part of the, you know, rank and file of the Mau Mau rebellion, those soldiers, right, would they ultimately get the, you know, would freedom mean that they will get the land that they fought for? And they would only get that land if there is a radical transformation of resources within, you know, post-colonial Kenya. And this really was what was at stake. So, you know, how do you shake the political power of the economic hold that Indians had on that sector of retail? What does it mean for Indians in terms of this mapping of race and space as a racial minority? And ultimately, is decolonization going to mean an absolute radical transformation of the colonial economy, that is, or is it simply going to be a transfer of power?
Right. And then the period that followed turned out to be one of Indian diaspora, right, which you take up in the in chapter 6, Uhuru and Exodus. So was the exodus of Indians that began in late 1960s Kenya an inevitable outcome of the racialized East African politics that you've charted, or is there more to this story? For example, we might think of the role of Britain and India in spurring these diasporas of East African Asians and the politics of citizenship that was implied there. And then also, what was the role of the racialized rhetoric within Kenyan independence movements themselves, and what claims did the Indians cling to during this process of decolonization in 1963?
So, you know, as a historian, I will say that there's never anything inevitable about any historical moment, right? That all moments are historically contingent. And yet, it is true that there were expulsions across the Indian Ocean and beyond in, you know, that period of decolonization. And in fact, you know, when we look at what's happening with the Rohingya in Myanmar, that is also, you know, what I would say is a kind of post-colonial expulsion that is ongoing. And it all comes back to that problem of defining nationhood as, you know, singular, as mapping territory onto race, right? And defining who belongs and citizenship. Now, you know, very, very specifically with the Indians in Kenya, I would say the exodus in the 1960s was not inevitable if we look at 1950, right, when that first call to independence was made by Indians and Africans. And it isn't as if there weren't the question of equity, economic resources, wages, and things weren't being, you know, those were battles that were being fought right through the 1930s. There were boycotts by African sort of organizations of Indian trade shops and things. So, you know, there was tension. I'm not saying that there wasn't any tensions of class and race, but there was no questioning that, well, you know, when we get independence, you'll all just be thrown out, right? You know, that idea of expulsion, the idea of expulsion in a carceral border, in fact, was a kind of European settler one when they tried to stop immigration. It wasn't necessarily an idea that was being that had much traction in the non-European anti-colonial public space. And then if we fast forward to the contemporary moment, back in 2018, I think, Indians, in fact, were recognized in East Africa as a tribe, like constitutionally, right? And again, this was a huge moment of diasporic belonging. So when we look at the long durée, I would say that you have anywhere in the world, you have borders and nationhood being defined. You have moments at which discourses of exclusion are deployed by the state to expunge. But then things seem to settle down. And then you have as many moments of belonging and claim making, like that moment when Indians were made into a tribe. So, I think the useful way of thinking about this question is really to think about post-colonial states as defining nationhood along racial, religious, and territorial lines. And you see this in every part of the, former British imperial world. India's partition, India's independence is not a moment where you have a complete radical transformation of the state. In fact, it is very much a transfer of power. And you have massive violence and a defining of nationhood along religious lines, right? And there's an actual sort of partition that takes place. In East Africa, it was more along these racial sort of and territorial lines. And the problems really are not the people who move across the borders, but the borders themselves. So, the idea of nationhood, again, as being a singular one, and it's always contested, which is why you continue to have all of these splits in terms of claim making. But the idea of nationhood and the negotiations over nationhood happened really in Kenya in the late 1950s, early 1960s. So I would say that by that point, it seemed like perhaps it was inevitable. Yes, you can see the writing on the wall sometimes 2 or 3 years out, but I wouldn't say that it was inevitable from the moment of migration out in the late 19th century. And I would also say that it wasn't the only way in, not everyone left, and it wasn't the only way in which the tension of race and class was manifested itself and was accommodated, because you didn't have everyone leaving. And in fact, there's a substantial population that stayed behind and remains sort of behind. What was very interesting, but what gets lost in, again, some of the overview of, these expulsions are taking place everywhere is, again, something that was very particular to Kenya. And as I was writing this chapter and, looking at what is fairly boring material of, statecraft and sort of these legislative assembly debates and things, boring to me, not to all. But what I noticed was that, in fact, what happens with Kenyatta state is that there's a massive leftist challenge to him. So Jomo Kenyatta becomes, the president in 1963. He had been the leader of the Kenya-Africa Union and, in fact, had been one of the first to be picked up when the emergency was declared and the rebellion broke out, was picked up and thrown into exile by the colonial state that, wrongly thought that he was the mastermind behind the rebellion. But Kenyatta was very much of that older generation, and it's the younger generation who were pushing against him and saw his politics as somewhat conservative, although once he's jailed, he's sort of, deployed as the father of the nation. But, this is just to say that when Kenyatta becomes a prime minister, president, he does not, in fact, initiate a radical transformation of the Kenyan economy. In fact, what he ends up doing is to negotiate with the British state to find a way in which land will be bought and then sold back to the person who can buy it. And the person who could buy it was essentially the European settlers. So the European settlers, in fact, end up owning much of the land. Kenyatta's own sort of political clique ends up owning some of that land as well. But what happens is that, within the first 5 to 6 years of independence, it's clear to all those who fought for independence, particularly those who had really been part of that land and freedom army and expected that independence would bring them land, they found that, in fact, Kenyatta was not, initiating this radical transformation. And within his own government, there was a leftist threat to him. His own vice president basically takes a strong stand against this. And his own vice president's right-hand man was P.O. Gama Pinto. And P.O. Gama Pinto ends up being the first political assassination in Kenya. And so what we had is, in fact, it wasn't so much race, but the politics of the left that makes Kenyatta state super nervous in the early late 1960s. And by the time you get the expulsions, what you really have is Kenyatta saying, okay, there's this moment, there's an election coming up, there is a leftist threat, so let me do the populist thing. And the populist thing is to basically, pick up an anti-immigrant rhetoric right before election time. I mean, all of this is so familiar to us right now in the 21st century. He's like, I want to divert away from the leftist threat by essentially picking up a populist stance of picking out the Asians, and he tries to do this. The Indians, in the meanwhile, are making, in this landscape, are making the claim to belonging, right? Because those who had wanted to leave left at independence. They had British passports, many of them left. But many of them, in fact, the majority of them stayed in Kenya. And as they began to see the writing on the wall in terms of the expulsions, it wasn't really even expulsions in Kenya. It was a series of legislative legislations that were passed to squeeze the trader out. And when the Indians see this, but when they hear that discourse of, the Indian who's a hangover from colonialism, it's the presence of the Indian trader rather than Kenyatta's economic policies that have kept Africans in poverty. That kind of, as they begin to hear this, their response is to say, well, we belong here because we built the nation. And when they said that they built the nation, what they end up doing really is deploying that early 20th century civilizing claims of modernity of the early traders and saying, look, but we've been here since Kenya was a nation. We brought trade here. We modernized Kenya. So in the post-colonial moment, they are deploying the same modernizing, sub-imperialist, if you want to call them, claims. But they are making those claims, they are deploying that language to make a claim to post-colonial belonging, citizenship, and nationhood.
Yeah, and it's that familiarity of the anti-immigrant rhetoric that you spoke mm-hmm. to that makes me want to ask kind of a presentist question mm-hmm. in relation to the epilogue. So as you point out in throughout the book, really, Enoch Powell was specifically mm-hmm. referring to the potential mass migration of Indians from post-colonial Kenya when he warned in the infamously racist 1968 Rivers of Blood speech of a flood of Black migrants overtaking Britain. Mm-hmm. And so given Powell's centrality to, in a British context, the race-based enclosure of Commonwealth migration post-1968, but then also sort of his continuing influence on far-right ethno-nationalist movements, both within and outside of Britain. Brexit is an example of an event in Enoch Powell's shadow. Is there more to say about how this history of East African Asian diaspora that the book outlines might better inform our understanding of these sort of wide and pressing political struggles that are being fought today?
That's a great question, and one that I think a lot about, especially in terms of the reception of the book and some new work that I'm doing. There are a couple of ways of thinking about this. Now, on the one hand, I think that the presence of Indian migrants, on the one hand, we have to think about mobility and try and make the argument that mobility is a human right, right? People have moved across space much before borders were defined. In fact, the border comes after and in a way comes to stop that mobility. And yet, even in terms of our politics, even if it is liberal politics, we think about mobility, the border coming first and mobility coming after. But in fact, the border comes second. It's, people are mobile for a host of people, ideas are mobile for a host of reasons, goods, of course, are. And I think that we really have to, as historians, think about if we say, well, mobility is a human right, what do we mean by that? And what does that help us do in terms of political mobilization, in terms of, spatial imagination, but also in terms of how citizenship is defined and deployed. Now, the presence of Indian migrants in many, many countries, and we, just off the top of my head, I think of Myanmar, I think of, you know, Malaysia, Singapore, I think of Fiji, I think of the British Caribbean, I think of, you know, which includes Trinidad, I think of British Guyana, I think of Mauritius, of course, East Africa, South Africa. You know, Indians, because of this belonging to that empire over which the sun never set, they ended up sort of not only moving in large scale to different parts of the world, but even when the sun finally set on British colonialism, they remained, and they had been there at this point for generations. And they are, and then all those tensions of race and place and belonging and the political economy really recur, and they end up having these moments of expulsion. But what they really are a reminder to us is, and I think this is what is useful in thinking of this in the contemporary moment, is that these migrants are, in a way, the long afterlives, not just of colonialism, but of nation building and modernity, right? Of the kind of modernity that emerges in the 19th century with the empire. But of course, you know, the end of the British Empire isn't the end of capitalism, of modernity, of mobility, of nationhood, of the carceral borders that were absolutely tied up to this sort of imperial moment. And migrants are central to the 20th century discourses and definitions of nationhood in all post-colonial countries. And when I say post-colonial country, I mean Britain as well. You know, we think about Britain as being the metropole, and then, you know, India, Kenya, Pakistan as being sort of all the colonies that became post-colonial nations. But in fact, Britain itself becomes a post-colonial nation as it decolonizes. And I think what is very useful to think about in terms of the history of Indians in Kenya who ultimately end up in Britain is, you know, one, that question that you raised about inevitability and expulsions. I think that, you know, as I said, expulsions are historically contingent, and we must remember the historical, the contingencies, the processes, the factors that lead to that particular moment as a way to be vigilant against it. We can be vigilant against it by always looking at the alternative trajectories, right? It's so easy for all of us to believe, well, you know, Indians kind of didn't belong. They were there as part of the imperial mission, you know, of the sort of colonizing state. They didn't end up integrating, you know, whatever quote unquote integrating means. And so, of course, they were thrown out. But in fact, you know, that kind of move, the nationalist move to try and claim a single story, means that we as historians sometimes don't look for the alternative trajectories, right? The people, the politics, the ideas that are kind of dismissed as unrepresentative. You know, someone like Makhan Singh or someone like Piyogama Pinto could very easily be dismissed as, well, you know, he was just an exceptional person and didn't represent anyone and was unrepresented. But in fact, they were representative, right? They were representative, not so much in terms, you know, we shouldn't judge them or their ideas as in terms of their mobilization, but what they represented was that particular historical moment where things were different and could have been. And I think that that really helps build solidarity, right? Interracial solidarity in particular. It builds empathy and it helps with mobilization. And, you know, one of the really incredible things, you know, I've now in a way been working, you know, this book has been with me part of my life for about 15 years. And I got, you know, the generational shifts, even amongst Asians in East Africa, but certainly amongst sort of the second, third generation in the UK, the way in which this story, this book has been received and the kind of activism and mobilization and memorialization of their own personal histories that are taking place in the UK, I think, are a real testament to how there is a contemporary resonance to this question of immigration, and that, you know, these are all these tensions around racial, class, migrant sort of positions are ones that really show us the long afterlife and the ultimately unresolved issues of colonial modernity that is very much part of our contemporary landscape.
Yeah, thanks for going through the book. I think, you know, as you've demonstrated, it certainly speaks to these sort of stunningly broad and pressing political questions beyond specifically Indian Ocean and East African context, though it speaks to them as well. So, Sana, we've taken up a lot of your time. So just to close, can I ask you, what are you working on now? Could you tell us about your current and future projects or what you hope to work on?
Sure. So I have, at the moment with COVID, I think everything has come to a bit of a standstill. And my most immediate and urgent project is just using this time to read. It's time that I haven't been able, because I'm not able to go out and do research at the moment. And my headspace isn't quite in writing. So I've been reading a lot. But I do have two research projects. One is a smaller one, which is in some ways I've been grappling with for longer. And one is a larger book project. The smaller one is really looking at the experiences of soldiers from Western and Eastern Africa who came to India and Burma and were deployed on the Burma front during the Second World War. There were close to 100,000, if not more, of them, and they spent, between 1943 and 1947, several years in South Asia. And some of them even met Gandhi. Some of them encountered on the road Indians from East who had spent 20 years in East Africa, learn Swahili and come back, and literally there's a chance encounter. So I've been able to uncover a very intimate archive of fragments, because that's all that they are, where we get actual African voices on their experience of being in South Asia. And I'm sort of working on that as a small one-off essay. And the bigger project, the bigger sort of book project is one that looks at Burma and India in the 1930s. I'm looking at that moment when I started with the moment when British India, included Burma, and then in 1935, the Government of India Act separates Burma from India. And the separation, although it's a kind of administrative government separation, in fact, it created on that frontier a border, a carceral border, for the very first time in the history of South Asia. And, this is a border where I wouldn't even call it immigration, because you can't really be a migrant without a border. It was a space of mobility. And, close to 13 million from, the Indian, what we would call now sort of India, migrated to, circulated between Burma and back in the period between the 1830s and the 1930s. But there was sort of Burmese nationalist movement to stop that, and that's sort of connected with this moment of 1935. So in terms of conceptualization, I'm really thinking about the 1935 administrative separation of Burma from India as South Asia's first partition, and I'm trying to recover Burma's South Asian history, looking at mobility, politics, and everyday living, because Burma, we were talking a little bit about these, about the Africanists and me being a South Asianist who's an interloper, but even when we think about this field that we call South Asia, Burma is almost never included, and Burma, for some reason, is included as part of the Southeast Asia era studies and not South Asia, although it shares a long border. There's a lot of shared history. So I'm basically looking at this separation in 1935 as India's first partition as a means to recover Burma's South Asian history.
That sounds great. I look forward to reading some of that. So thank you, Sana, for joining us. And thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explored Indians in Kenya, The Politics of Diaspora, published by Harvard University Press in 2015. This is your host, Michael Ramore.
And I'm your co-host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi.
Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.